Welcome to Counterpower. I'm Nick Dearden, and today we're talking about the people's sport, football, and its fascinating relationship with anti-fascism and the political power of sport ahead of the 2026 World Cup. Donald Trump is bullying his way to a might makes right world order based on aggression, corruption, and warfare. A world order that threatens to devastate the international economy, increase inequality, accelerate climate collapse, and unleash violence before diplomacy. Now, throughout history, authoritarian regimes have used international sporting events to whitewash their reputations. This year, FIFA is set to make $11 billion on the World Cup with the most expensive tickets ever, and what a 2025 report by Scientists for Global Responsibility say will be the most polluting World Cup ever. But the World Cup is usually framed as a celebration of unity and joy around love for the sport. But this year's event, in Trump's America, is likely to become a site of repression and human rights abuses, despite Trump being given the first ever FIFA Peace Prize earlier this year. In fact, there was already a registered asylum seeker deported after being stopped for a minor civil offence at the Club World Cup final in the US in June of last year. And in Trump's America, where we've seen thousands of people illegally detained and deported, media companies pressured to fire journalists who criticised the president, and people shot in the street for peacefully protesting, the risks for both local communities and visitors cannot be overstated. The Stop Trump Coalition is running a campaign called Football Against Fascism, bringing international awareness to the human rights abuses being sportswashed by the United States being allowed to co-host this World Cup. There's so much to cover on this topic, so we're shaking up our podcast format a bit today and speaking to guests in three different segments. Coming up, I'll talk to Shaista Aziz of the Three Hijabis, Daniel Noronha from Amnesty International US. But first, I'm so pleased to introduce Chris Lee, football historian, lecturer, and author of several books, including The Defiant, The History of Football Against Fascism. In this book, Chris traces a fascinating history that stretches from the rise of fascism in Europe in the 1930s to anti-racist supporter movements, ultras, refugee football clubs, and fan-led organising today. At a moment when football is once again colliding with major political questions, from nationalism and propaganda to sports washing, migration and protest, Chris's work is especially relevant. The title itself, Football Against Fascism, is one that we've used in the Stop Trump Coalition in our campaign to raise awareness about ICE violence during the World Cup. So today I want to explore both the history and the present, how sport has been used by authoritarian movements, but also how players, supporters and communities have fought back, and what all of that means as we head into the World Cup 2026. Chris, welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to talk with you. We've got a lot of listeners who might not follow football closely. So I wonder if I can start by asking you, why does football matter politically, and why historically has it become such a battleground over identity, nationalism and resistance?
Brilliant. Well, firstly, thank you for having me on. And secondly, why is football so important? It's a platform. It's about the only global, truly global sport in many ways. It's the world's most popular sport. It's the one that sort of the traffic stops for and people go home from work early to see. And so that regard, it does mean a lot more to different countries and different parts of the world than it does elsewhere. And it is very much, especially for the global south, it's quite a level at times to compete with the global north. You know, for the great World Cup example is the quarterfinal of the World Cup in 1986 when Argentina took on England. It was Argentina's first game against England since the Falklands Malvinas conflict 4 years earlier, which they lost, and rather humiliating, and led to the end of the junta there. So it was in some ways payback from their point of view. And so it's kind of like for them, not Argentina and Diego Maradona, who scored twice in that one, the greatest goal of all time, and the other, the hand of God, which people might remember. But he became an icon in the entire global South because of that. And it was sort of seen as an anti-colonial moment as well. So, you know, it's kind of almost like football is political. It always has been. If we go back to like the codification of the game in 1863, if we see that as year zero for football in general, it was always, maybe in England, less political, as it always has been typically, less so in Scotland. As you know, there are sectarian issues there. But typically, it was pretty much just sociological issues until the working class kind of took over in the 1883 FA Cup final is seen as the moment when the working class takes over, because they Blackburn Olympic, which no longer exists, unfortunately, was a team that won, was the first working class northern team to win the FA Cup against the private school alumni of Old Etonians. And so the upper classes didn't win it again. And then they obviously professionalised and everything like that. So football was sociological in England, but it became political first time probably in Belfast in the 1890s, when you see sectarian violence come out and it's organised around football. Clubs had identities like Belfast Celtic, which is closely aligned, like its Glasgow equivalent, with the Irish community, or the Catholic community, I should say, in Belfast, like the Irish community in Glasgow at that time. But also then you had, they were often against, you know, their fans were often fighting against Protestant clubs from East Belfast. So we see it first getting utilised politically by fans organically more in those days. And it wasn't until the 1920s when we see football being used as an overtly political tool by a fascist state, with the very first fascist state, which is Mussolini's Italy. And he saw it very much as a way of unifying the country, because Italy had only been around since 1861. And it was all about, how do we make Italians? So he created Serie A, created strong teams like Roma, which was a merger of three clubs to make one strong Roman club. Lazio refused to join them. Lazio, some of you, the listeners, may well know, is the other club in Rome and has a famously far-right support fringe, shall we say. But they, you know, that wasn't anti-fascist action for them not to want to join. It was very much conscious, we don't want to be part of this project, want to be independent. Fiorentina, my team in Italy, unfortunately was also created by a merger of two teams to create a strong Florentine side. So kind of he then goes into the 1934 World Cup, as a lot of people might know, as that's the sort of first propaganda World Cup, really. And it's only the second ever World Cup. So to cut a long story short, football has always been political since the beginning, but it sort of didn't really become an actual conscious political tool to the 1920s. Obviously, then we see Adolf Hitler in 1936 kind of emulate that with the Berlin Olympics. And since then, we've seen sporadic World Cups become political things, like the Argentine Junta in 1978. A lot of controversy around that. And then, of course, recent World Cups have been controversial for where they're hosted more than anything. Like Russia, Qatar, and then obviously the current one that we'll be discussing today.
That's fascinating. So in a way, it really is this mirror of society. It becomes a battleground on which society's wider conflicts are played out. Because I've always thought of it as an extremely working class game. But from what you're saying, actually, it wasn't until the later 19th century when that really became the case.
Yeah, every country seems to have gone through a stage where it started off with the elites, political elites, social elites, and then eventually the working, predominantly man, but not always, working women as well, took over. And that was more to do with other sociological factors, such as time off to have the creation of the weekend, for example. So it wasn't until the Factory Acts in the 1870s that someone could actually have Sunday, Saturday afternoon off. And what do they do to spend that time? Oh, there's this new sport that people are playing called football. Let's go watch it. Let's go play it. And as I mentioned there, it's not just the working man, it's women as well. And a great example of anti-fascism in action was in Milan in the 1930s with the Calciatrici, which is the women footballers in Milan, who obviously Mussolini's state again wanted women to stay in the kitchen, not do anything athletic, certainly for gynecological reasons in their mind. And so these ladies kept playing anyway, and they now have a street named after them in Milan, which is a nice little touch.
It's fascinating. Let's stick with the same period, because I mean I only found out recently actually about this famous example in Berlin in 1938, where the English team gave the Nazi salute under pressure from the British government, and again that feels to me like quite a big turning point in terms of the use of football by governments and political forces in society.
Mm. Well, do you know what? It wasn't the first or the last time that there was some controversy around England and fascist states, because 3 years previous to that, Nazi Germany had played at White Hart Lane in a friendly. This is before Wembley was being used as the English national stadium. Although it was built, it wasn't used for it. So they used to rotate stadiums around London. So Highbury had been used before, for example. So they went to White Hart Lane, which, as anyone knows, Tottenham got highly high Jewish population. So that was obviously controversial from the choice of venue to start with. The Nazi German team turned up. There was a lot of protests. Someone even scaled the roof and managed to cut the swastikas down briefly. He then got charged later on for criminal damage and stuff like that. And then so that was controversial, a bit of a precursor as to what was going on. But 3 years later, things obviously deteriorated a lot more in Nazi Germany at this point. So it was the British public were far more cognizant of what was happening there. And obviously it was dividing. You still had, as we know, quite famously amongst certain elites, people who supported what was going on in Germany and those who didn't. And obviously appeasement was part of the political policy at this point. When we say appeasement, it's basically like not upsetting the German high command at this point. So what they did was, like you said, they made the England team do the salute. And they weren't alone, and they did it again in 1939 in Milan. So Mussolini wasn't even there for that. Hitler wasn't there in 1938 either. He only went to one football match in his life, as far as we know, and that was in the 36 Olympics. He stormed out when Germany lost, so to Norway. And then the Irish team also were made to do it, which is interesting. So they're by their own government, and that's for very different reasons in the late 30s. So it was kind of, again, the players didn't feel comfortable doing it. Stan Callis of Wolves famously said, "Count me out." And he didn't appear in that England match. So yeah, I mean, that's it. The football's there now. The photo is there forever now.
But that's fascinating that there was a real conflict going on in the team, because of course the organised working class in Britain, you know, were solidly against fascism. So
yes. I mean, this was just two years after the Cable Street battle, of course, which is when, if anyone's not familiar with it, definitely go have a look at the mural just off Cable Street in. It's in Limehouse or Stepney. And they just, you know, hundreds of thousands of local people blocking the police from clearing the way for a fascist march, which never actually got anywhere near them. So, but yeah, it's a fascinating part. A very, divisive period in British history, which are some of which we're sort of seeing mirrors of currently as well. So rival marches, etc.
Could you say a little bit, I mean, I knew nothing about this, but one of the really striking stories you talk about is this moment in 1936 when there was this plan for the People's Olympiad, kind of anti-fascist alternative to the 36 Berlin Olympics, which was derailed in the end, I believe. But I'm sure listeners will be absolutely fascinated, as I was, to hear about this.
Yeah, so I think it's in the late 20s or early 30s. It was Berlin versus Barcelona for the right to host the 1936 Olympics. Bear in mind that the German government that won the rights to host the 1936 Olympics was not the same one that came in 1933. So Berlin won the right to host it. Barcelona didn't. Now, what happened in that meantime, Barcelona has a rich history of anarcho-syndicalist history, which goes back to even some of their football clubs, stadiums being used as, like, you know, arms dumps and stuff during the various uprisings they've had. And what happened was this, as a counter to the 1936 Olympics and what had happened in Germany since, a lot of international athletes said, you know what, let's get together and Barcelona, which could have hosted it and has this nice stadium, and let's go there instead. Lots of Jewish athletes would obviously felt a lot safer there as well. And so, yes, there were various national teams that descended on Barcelona in July of 1936 for an alternative Olimpiada Popular, as it was known, the Olympics, in this sort of free-spirited, free Barcelona, but it's during the Second Spanish Republic. So they'd kind of shaken off the shackles of royalty and Carlism and all the other things about they didn't like about Spanish society at the time. But of course, the people that had been edged out, the powers that be, the military, the church, they were all, landowners, they were all conspiring to get that power back through a coup that happened in July of 1936, which was instigated by several generals in the North African or the Moroccan Spanish army in Morocco, and one of whom was General Francisco Franco, who some of you may be familiar with, became the dictator of Spain after the Spanish Civil War. But anyway, just in that mid-July, just literally a day before it was due to start, I think it was around the 16th or 17th of July, that's when the coup, the uprising, is announced,
and the
soldiers leave the barracks trying to sort of take over and secure the various streets. They did take some places and some others fought back, including Barcelona, famously. And again, sports grounds were used as weapons dumps by the anarcho-syndicalists and communists and various others on the left. And this is kind of basically the sport couldn't happen. And so the Olimpiada Popular never took place. But it's really interesting, as you mentioned, as a sort of counterweight to that, the Berlin Olympics did happen, you know, the following month, whatever it was, that this there was this movement to big enough to generate an entire alternative sports competition to sort of say, we're not part of this, we don't agree with it.
It's absolutely amazing. And so to bring that a little bit more up to date, and I guess think about where we may see similar resonances, I found out about the ultras that you talk about in the context of the Egyptian rising around 2008. And of course, I'd grown up thinking about kind of stuff that happens at football as hooliganism, basically. Right. I mean, I lived for a while near Millwall in the early 90s. So I was very well versed in that kind of football violence. And so when I heard about it in Egypt, I was absolutely fascinated and didn't really know what it meant and had heard it had played this role in the uprising. Maybe you could explain a little bit about that and explain whether it happens elsewhere as well.
Ultras, yeah, they're a global phenomenon.
Yeah.
And we have to be careful here to separate them from hooliganism.
Yeah.
Ultras especially just basically means to go beyond, effectively, in kind of Latin. So it's kind of like extreme. So extreme fans, they have certain traits, like, you know, you'd have seen them in recent European finals. The great example is Crystal Palace against Rayo Vallecano in the recent Conference League final. Both have got really, really positive ultras. So non-violent, progressive, inclusive ultras who create TIFO, so that's big displays, choreography. They'll have someone like called a capo, usually the Italian word, for who will shout, lead the chanting with the megaphone, so they keep the noise coming for 90 minutes. There'll be a lot of flares on the street. Some even get into the ground, but they're not meant to be. And they're pretty much universal. They've been ultra culture came around. Well, it's been in Italy, for example, and since the 60s, started out as a left-wing thing, became unfortunately mostly right-wing thing, but around the world, you'll see them everywhere. The Argentinian equivalent is called the Barra Brava, which is very different. There's far more kind of organized crime involved in that, unfortunately. Not exclusively, I should say that. There's, you know, some are very good, just there for the atmosphere. But yeah, no, ultras can be anything from some, you know, fun-loving people, fans just getting together, waving flags, hitting drums, banging drums, and just like singing. And to kind of, like you said, extreme politicized on either side, verging on violence sometimes as well. And that does happen in places like Italy. And as you mentioned, North Africa is particularly in Morocco and Egypt, the ultras are particularly strong in those footballing cultures. But you get them everywhere. Indonesia, so I mean, people never necessarily think of it. Indonesia got a massive ultra scene. Really, really interesting. So yeah, there are everywhere. And they are, some of them are politically active and lean on clubs to get their way sometimes.
It's really interesting, and there seems to be. I wouldn't put it in the same category necessarily, but even here in Britain, there is a kind of emerging this idea of clubs associated with political ideas of the left. Mm. And I mean, Clapton FC, you know, very close to where I am.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. As kind of emerged in recent years, right, as this football club where the players are very political in their ideas, but the fans are really political, and it's almost like a political day out coming to see a football team. And I know that you have that example in Germany and elsewhere on a much bigger scale as well, Italy as well.
Yeah, no, I think it probably started with FC St. Pauli of Hamburg.
That's of course,
quite famously in the 70s and 80s was kind of standing up for squatters' rights and things like that in the area. Caught on places like Rayo Vallecano, caught up with it. They've been going since the 90s, the Bucaneros, which is their big ultra group there, doing things like social justice in the community of Vallecas, is the world's largest barrio, they call it. There's this neighborhood within Spain, Madrid, which has kind of got absorbed into Madrid. It's actually very working class, always has been, but Rayo has always been the sort of like the symbol of that area. So they look after people, so people, you know, where rent control was an issue, they helped some particular people out. You know, so there's lots of things going on. That has, like I said, it's more prevalent in more politically charged countries, I suppose, like Italy and Germany. But there is a small politicized club scene here, like you mentioned, Clapton Community Football Club, which I've got the shirt off here, which is inspired by the flag of the Second Spanish Republic, celebrate the International Brigades, which is International Brigades, this little sort of Troy color here. It was made by an independent sports brand in Italy. So, yeah, I mean, that was really popular. And that sort of like was made in 2018 to create awareness of and celebrate the people from the Newham area of East London that went to the Spanish Civil War to support the anti-fascist movement there. But the if so popular that they keep doing they keep producing it now, 9 years on or so, 8 years on. And then actually Dulwich Hamlet is another great example, south of the river, which used to be my local club, so I'm, you know, quite get there quite regularly. Again, doing great things, really inclusive crowd, really you'll see far higher proportion of female support there than you would at most grounds. Likewise for the women's team as well, you'll see far more your male support than you would usually at those things. So it's kind of like, it's very symbiotic. And they have a similar kind of ethos, I suppose, to Clapton, which is great. Do a lot of good stuff in the local community, lots of joined marches and things. I think the two of them I've seen have come together on recent marches, actually. And the club, the other shirt behind me is Bohemians of Dublin over in Ireland, who have been very political. Kind of, they've been fan-owned, one of the only two fan-owned clubs in the top flight in Ireland, and they've been political since their beginning in the 1890s. But in particular, recent years, under their kind of current ownership, they've, and kind of the fans leading the way, really, they've become this kind of very politicised, very outspoken, especially when you've got, say, the Irish national side hosting Israel coming up soon in the Nations League. And that's kind of very controversial at the moment over there. So they've done fundraisers for Palestine and things like that. So it's not everyone's cup of tea over there, for example, especially rival clubs use that as a bit of a stick to beat them with. But it's really interesting to see football as the platform for these movements in, like I said, lower league English football or Irish, the League of Ireland. It's not, these aren't sort of like, you know, the Premier League or anything with loads of global attention. These are kind of small leagues, but things are happening there. It's really interesting.
And do you see it, and I'll get onto the World Cup after this. I'm so fascinated mm-hmm. by this. But do you see it in some of the big corporate clubs as well? There have been fan clubs that have got very political, mostly about the ownership of their club, right? And the price of tickets and so on. But of course, that provides a space for a discussion of other politics through, you know, fans being organised and so on. Now, I'm just fascinated that it is such a corporate-dominated game now with so much money at stake. How has that affected the politics around it?
Yeah, I think the higher up you go in the leagues, the harder it is for a player to have a position, really, unless it's something like, Marcus Rashford, there you are, example, on right. working with schools and meals and things like that. And I think that was a great example where a player can do some good things, but you don't really see the top level political statements or political activity. And that, to be fair, you haven't ever really in English football anyway, as far as I can remember.
Going back to kind of early 20th century, late 19th century, it would.
On an individual level, not really. Yeah, people like Brian Clough, who's a famously socialist, and therefore also, you know, I guess. Bill Shankly famously as well. And of course, Liverpool as a club, has always had a working class ethic, and particularly in the 1980s when it was having a terrible time off the pitch but a great time on it. And at the same time, you know, they were up against the Thatcher government. So you did have that juxtaposition between Liverpool and the rest, if you know what I mean. So there is some kind of, there is that element within it, but you don't often get players taking individual political stances. You know, good on anyone that does, but it is incredibly hard. Like you said, they've got like image rights, you've got like contracts and things like that to sort of, even after they finish, they don't really see that, you don't see that many outspoken, you know.
We've got Gary Lineker, I guess, who's,
I suppose, example.
Such a big figure, really, on the left now, but you're right, of course.
But he's an outlier.
He's one
though,
of
isn't
many,
he?
Yeah, of course. So let's move on to the World Cup, which is clearly on a completely different geopolitical stage from other football games. And this year it's coming to North America. Mm-hmm. There are already political tensions very visible around the tournament. And you know, some Americans have been saying, who don't support Trump, have been saying, you know, we don't think it should be held here, and we don't think people should come here, and it's not safe for them. But every World Cup, in a way, is kind of surrounded by, I mean, on the one hand, these ideas of kind of unity and peace, and we all love football and it brings the whole world together. And on the other hand, this kind of nationalism and the money and the image management and so on.
Mm.
How do you kind of navigate that as a football fan? And how do you think people should think critically about that contradiction?
Yeah, I mean, I won't be going personally. And I think there's a number of reasons people aren't going. One, the money, the cost of tickets to get there, and also, you know, even to travel to the stadium to park. There's the fear about, you know, ICE agents. You know, some countries aren't being allowed or struggling to get visas. And we've got a situation where I can't remember another example of when one of the host countries has been actively bombing one of the other participants. So I think that's unprecedented. But each three countries come with their own challenges. Canada probably least, you know, the least problematic, to be honest. But Mexico obviously has a lot of drug violence going on at the minute. So it's, you know, I think fans that are going there are probably not blind to the potential, you know, risks of going. I think as football supporters, is up to, you know, it's up to individuals as to either whether they can afford to go or whether they, you know, want to endorse the World Cup in this way, so by going along. So it is, like you said, it is hard. Of course, the message is always going to be football brings us together. In many ways it will, but where will that be? That might probably be down at, you know, down at the pub or wherever you happen to be watching it. I think what my biggest concern is what happens when, like, the police that aren't used to European fan culture encounter European fan culture. Going back to what I said about the ultras, and we want to be able to walk to the stadium, and which we can't do, you know. And if anyone's been on the Dutch fan march, as I have, which is just the best fun you could ever have, and you've got tens of thousands of people jumping to the left, jumping to the right in orange, and it's hilarious. And so it's, you know, but then you've got other fans whose songs might be a little bit what they would call banter, but some people might take offense at. And then, you know, speaking in English, for example, and they will be able to understand it. It's like, where's that going to lead? And, you know, and obviously people that may well be affected by alcohol and the sun, where they're never a great combination. So I that's my only concern, is how, you know, if there's a culture clash, shall we say, and what happens then.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that, because, of course, the US is a country that doesn't have the same political culture as a huge lot of the world around football.
I mean, it has soccer, but the soccer is very, you know, American sports are very kind of turn up, you know, whoop a little bit and then leave. It's not that, there's not that 90 minutes of passionate singing, etc. So I don't know. We'll see.
And then on the kind of looking at a bigger scale, I mean, we've got the World Cup coming up. The US is going to be hosting the Olympics in 2028. I mean, I guess, is there anything, we've already talked a little bit about the People's Olympiad, but I suppose I'm thinking about as the world becomes more conflicted, as tensions get deeper, do you see a fragmentation of kind of some of the international bodies around the sport of football and the possibility for different countries and different teams to organise alternatives?
Potentially, but I haven't seen any movement towards that yet. I think we have seen, the only thing we've seen of that ilk in recent years is of that breakaway European Super League thing that people wanted to, certain clubs wanted to create, and was slapped down pretty quickly by fans. But yeah, where other organisations to go, do you know what, we want to create our own tournament or whatever? I don't know. I haven't seen any signs of that, but I mean, it may well, I would guess it depends how far people were willing to, I said, what they're willing to take, really. I'd like the idea of, you know, I say, oh, I went to the World Cup in 2014, only cost £100, it worked out, per ticket for a group stage match. And I think that's fair. I don't think spending 1,000 plus is going to attract too many people, but there we are.
Yeah. And let's see. I mean, you know, it's really interesting. I mean, heaven forbid that I compare football with Eurovision, but, you know, some of the divisions that we saw in the Eurovision Song Contest are really interesting and reflecting the politics of the world that we're in now.
Yeah, 100%.
So, Chris, I have enjoyed that so much because there was a whole lot there I didn't know, and I would really encourage anybody who is as interested as me to read The Defiant. Thanks for all your work on this, and thanks for joining us today.
Brilliant. Thank you very much indeed.
Up next, I'm joined by Daniel Noronha from Amnesty International US, which is doing incredible work defending human rights amid Trump's ongoing attack on migrants and vulnerable people. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us today. On the first anniversary of President Trump's inauguration, Amnesty International described the USA as facing a human rights emergency, with a recognizable pattern of authoritarian practices and erosion of human rights that Amnesty has documented for decades across countries worldwide. This year, Amnesty issued a travel advisory for visitors to the US, as well as a report entitled Humanity Must Win, Defending Rights, Tackling Repression at the 2026 FIFA World Cup, which we'll be discussing today, and we'll link in the show notes for you to read. Daniel, it's been horrifying for those of us outside the US to witness the Trump administration's attacks on all fronts, but especially, of course, on immigration, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, which are a major focus of your report. And we know that we're not getting all of the news here. Indeed, it's difficult to keep up with the news that we are getting. But maybe you could tell listeners a little bit about the current situation in the US and your biggest concerns as the World Cup is about to kick off.
Sure. Well, thank you, Nick, for the invitation and for following Amnesty International work on this. For those who might not be aware, Amnesty International is one of the largest human rights organizations in the world. We're a membership-based organization. We have 10 million members all over the world. Here in the United States, we are around 250,000, 300,000 now. So we have presence in different parts of the world. The work that have we doing in the World Cups has been historical. The first time that Amnesty was involved in the World Cup was in the Argentinian World Cup, when we started a campaign regarding the torture of political prisoners back during the dictatorship in Argentina. And we have been involved in this type of process before. Now, turning to the U.S., to the current situation, as you mentioned, we issued a report says ringing the alarms on the human rights crisis that the United States is facing in the Trump administration and what that involves. We are very concerned about the heightening of what we call authoritarian practices and the erosion of the rule of law. Coupled with that, we're seeing an over-policing of communities, especially immigrant communities. And with that, we're also seeing a racial discrimination for policing purposes. All of that gives us a very bleak outlook on what the World Cup will look like. That's why we join other organizations that are part of what is called the Dignity 26 Coalition, that is being headed by different grassroots organizations and national organizations, such as the ACLU, the Georgetown O'Neill Institute, the AFL-CIO. So there are groups that are also tracking this and decided to also call out the people who might be wanting to come to the U.S. to raise, to have more awareness of what will they encounter. So we, in our report, what we saw is basically three things that we are concerned with. So the first one is freedom of expression and freedom of the press. We have seen that in the course of this first year, there have been several instances where the government is actually harassing either journalists or people who are wanting to express their concerns on different issues, and they are being retaliatory in that sense. And this is being expressed by the second part that we are worried or concerned about, which is immigration enforcement. So any type of repression that is exercised by the U.S. government is being systematized through immigration enforcement. So immigration enforcement is what is driving the authoritarian practices and how the government is dealing with the crisis. We have a campaign that is called Stop the Mass Deportation Machine, that is basically that. We wanted to stop these practices in the context of how immigration works in this country. And we're seeing that it's being weaponized against different people who are either opponents of the current administration or who have a specific profile that is not wanted by the administration, especially with people who are immigrants or immigrants communities are coming from different parts of the country. And this was even exacerbated by a ruling of the Supreme Court, where it basically said that racial profiling was allowed in this type of context by ICE. In that same sense, what we are seeing is, for example, how immigration and customs enforcement is being basically deputized by the rest of federal agencies. So whether you're seeing vests that say FBI or HSI, which are different other federal law enforcement agencies, everything is eyes at this point, basically, I would like to say. Like, everything is just working now to work towards the mass deportation of people, or using immigration enforcement as this type of excessive censorship of opponents, of journalists, of political activists, of human rights defenders, you name it. So this is where we're looking into now, and where we are concerned what will happen in during the tournament. We're seeing already happening before the tournament. There are several rumors of certain teams being denied visas, certain journalists having issues to even enter the country. So these are things that we see that could happen and could hinder the game in general, the tournament. One thing that I think is important to make clear is that the travel advisory was not meant to deter people from traveling. Actually, we, in our recommendations, the groups that we sign into this, we never say or we never intend to tell people, you know what, don't travel to the US. We're actually saying, like, we understand that a lot of people also, this is like their livelihoods, like a lot of workers depend on it. There are the unions, like, understand the risk, but also understand that there are people that who need this work as well. So we were just saying with this, the travel advisory was, if you want to come, this is what you will face, basically. So this is where we are right now, and this is how we see that things could escalate in the future.
So that's really clear on the demand. So you've got protecting freedom of expression and assembly, ending indiscriminate raids and unlawful deportations, lifting discriminatory travel bans, and I think there's stuff in there on taking effective measures to protect LGBTQI communities too. Have you had any response yet from FIFA or from any of the host countries?
Well, FIFA has been clear in conversations that we had that they are looking for reassurances from the federal government, especially in the US, that they will ask the federal government to provide assurances that the tournament will go easily, that there will be no external pressures, either to players, fans, or the football community in general. Nonetheless, those compromises have not been met. We are not seeing like clear demands or implementation of the human rights safeguards that they have. FIFA has a human rights policy that was published, I think, more than 10 years ago, and supposedly they have to abide by that. But for example, when the World Cup started, we saw that FIFA brought down from their website all their material surrounding discrimination. So we are seeing different things that perhaps doesn't give us a good signal that they are actually doing something more. At the same time, most of the host cities had to develop what we call a human rights plan, an action plan. So they were supposedly to have already policies in place that will prevent this from happening, or actually trying to have some sort of mechanism or policy framework that would allow host cities to work with local officials and the federal government for the protection and safeguard of human rights during the tournament. I think from the host cities in the US, we have only seen like 7 or 6 perhaps human rights plans or pledges or statements of intention of what they're trying to do. So, and then it's a little too late because they were supposedly to come in February, but then they moved it to May and the rollout has been very slow. In Guadalajara, in Mexico City and Vancouver and Ontario, in Toronto, I think they have I have not seen again if they're working for towards it, but they should as well. So we need to see those commitments more bring forward, especially from local officials. Noting how I said before, like everything is eyes now, everything can be used for immigration enforcement purposes. And what we're seeing this more concerning is in cities where we have 287G agreements, which are basically agreements between local officials and the federal government, where local law enforcement can be used and is as immigration enforcement. So, for example, you end up having a brawl outside of a bar, or you're having a heated argument with a driver if going to the game, like any type of those like local things that will command attention could eventually, for example, lead you to be carried out and expelled out of the country. So these type of things is what concerns us, that we're not seeing those clear commitments from FIFA, how they're really trying to bring forward this put forward policies of actually stopping human rights abuses.
And there's been quite a lot of back and forth on whether ICE will be officially involved in World Cup security. Do you know the latest on that?
What we've seen, I think, is that in Los Angeles and somewhere else, there has not been already a commitment from local officials that ICE will not be present. Then again, that's the prerogative of the federal government. So if the federal government eventually insists that they will need Homeland Security Administration, which basically means that it doesn't need to be actually ICE, it just needs to be any law enforcement, federal law enforcement to be there, they will be used as immigration law enforcement. That's I think the most important thing that people need to understand. Like, it doesn't matter if it says ICE or not, as long as it says like federal law enforcement, it could be a US Marshal, an FBI agent, even the Secret Service, even the park police who are in charge of protecting the national parks are being used for federal law, immigration law enforcement activities. So that's where we are standing right now.
Got you. Thank you. Things move very, very fast in American politics at the moment. In 2028, we know that Los Angeles will host the Olympics. Unfortunately, it doesn't look at the moment as if our fight for human rights will be over by that point. What lessons do you think we can learn from our approach to the World Cup, and how can we make sure humanity wins next time?
Oof, loaded question. Well, I mean, the point here is that we're dealing from a perspective of how we make effective human rights is when policymakers really engage with the issue. And they really want to put this as a cornerstone in their policy building. Unfortunately, in the last past years, we haven't seen that commitment to really go through there. So I will say that if we really want to continue to win this, we cannot stop engaging them. We cannot stop being present, making noise. Like with any human rights fight, I will say, they come in incremental changes, but they don't come in a vacuum. You need to be pressing on them. Like, you need to be making the demands. You need to be present in either as an organization, as an individual, making your voice heard. So I think it's important that one thing that I will say for the World Cup is that I believe that like 2 or 3 years ago, people were like having these conversations, but because everybody was so worried about the next election and what was going to happen, people kind of downplaying what was happening with the World Cup. So now at this point, everybody's like, okay, this is a big deal. How are we going to deal with it? So perhaps now with the Olympics coming and for next year, especially because it's going to be in California, really centralized, I think there's going to be like a different factors that could set these things in a different manner.
Fantastic. And if there's one final thing that you'd like people to really take home with them from this report, what would you say?
I will say that from the report is that the more you demand on what is needed and the more you pressure all the stakeholders surrounding the World Cup, so that is not only the host countries, but there's also the corporate sponsors. There's also your own football associations. For example, if you want to have a stronger voice at the FIFA government body, you have to pressure your National Football Association to make those demands. I believe that fans have more power than they think so. There have been some examples in football history where that has been shown. And I think that it's important for them to continue engaged and to see that the report lays out the danger, but also the solutions on how to deal with them.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Daniel. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for all the work that you're doing to defend, protect, and extend human rights in the US. And we'll drop some links into the podcast notes so that people know how they can follow you and support you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next up, my guest is a good friend and colleague, Shaister Aziz. Shaister is one of the co-founders of the Three Hijabis, campaigners who help organizations to address racism, misogyny, and Islamophobia, and have successfully galvanized well more than 1 million people to sign an anti-racism petition to hold racists accountable for weaponizing the game of football. Since then, they have taken their campaign to Parliament and inside the hallowed halls of the Football Association, the Premier League, as well as speaking on panels across the UK and internationally to build a mass community of anti-racist activists in sports. Shaister, welcome. I imagine that you and your colleagues in the Three Hijabis have been very busy at the moment in the run-up to the World Cup. I can see you are wearing your football T-shirt there. So thank you very much for spending the time and joining us on the podcast today.
Hi, Nick. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure. Could you tell us a little bit, first of all, about why you started the Three Hijabis and what the response has been?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Three Hijabis roared into life in 2022. It followed England hosting the Euros, the men's Euros at the time. The competition was happening behind the backdrop of COVID, the COVID pandemic. So the competition was delayed. And then when the competition eventually kicked off, England managed to get to the finals, which for those of us who are long-suffering England fans who support the men's team and the women's team, we know the women's team know how to win those big competitions. The men's team are still kind of lagging behind a little bit, but hopefully that's going to change this year. Let's see. But three of our young black England players were subjected to grotesque levels of racist abuse following a penalty shootout against Italy, which very sadly England lost. And it was really horrifying to see, you know, these national heroes being abused in this way. They went out to do their job to play football wearing the England shirt, and racists thought it was okay to abuse them, which obviously it's not. So the Three Hijabis are three British Muslim women who happen to wear the hijab, the headscarf. We were outraged watching this game, very devastated. So we launched a petition the morning after the night before of the ugly scenes at Wembley Stadium. And our petition called on football, tech companies and the government of the day that was being headed up by Prime Minister Boris Johnson, the well-known anti-racist, to call on football to clean up its act and to ban racists from football. And the response, Nick, was incredible. We had more than 1 million people sign our petition in less than 48 hours. And I think what we did was we captured the imagination of decent-minded people across the UK who were outraged by what they were seeing. They were devastated like we were. They were trying to work out how to explain this to their children, you know, to the young people in their lives in particular. We had school teachers contact us. We had lots of people from all walks of life contact us just saying, thank you so much for doing this. And I think what we did is we tapped into something very important and very powerful, which is to remind people, you don't have to be passive. You don't have to be passive witnesses to racism, to fascism, to horror. And if you're a decent-minded person, you have to speak up and you have to stand up. So, yeah, we got more than 1.2 million signatures in the end. Our petition was talked about by the Prime Minister in Parliament. And since then, we have become a platform that tackles all forms of racism, including anti-blackness, Islamophobia, anti-Semitism. And we look at the intersections of race and gender justice in relation to football. So that's who we are, and that's how we came to life.
And I always think you're very courageous, right? Because you really love the sport, and you love many sports, actually, because I know that you've been to the cricket down close to our office as well, and we're told you were at the wrong door once because there was an assumption that you were a member of staff, right? So it's not only explicit racism, but a lot of the assumptions that people have about fans of these sports. And that means, I imagine, that when you're watching a game, you can't just be enjoying it like everybody else, right? You're also expected to be representing a whole community of people. And how do you juggle that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting observation and question, Nick. So not only what you've said really resonates with me, but also if you are a marginalized person and you're going to a football game, you may be marginalized in a way that is not visible. So if you're a member of the LGBTQI community, for example, you know, football has never been welcoming space. And I think even now it struggles to be for our siblings from the LGBTQI community. But if you are someone who has a visible different identity, in the case of Muslim women who choose to wear the hijab, you do stand out. And what I found is that you are in a state of hypervigilance. So you're constantly looking around and you're kind of taking three or four steps of thinking, you know, you have to think fast to anticipate what may happen. And as someone who loves football, I don't have a team. People always ask me about my team. I'm like, I have a team. I used to have one. We won't go into that now. But I don't have one. I love the game. I like to go to all sorts of football games. I often go by myself. And I do see discomfort amongst people who are around me wondering, like, what is she doing here? Why is she here? At the same time, people often I find are very protective of me. So they're looking out for me as well because they're not daft. They can see what's going on. They can see how much racism, very sadly, has become very overt in this country since Brexit in particular and since the years that have passed. You know, we are seeing a very ugly atmosphere in this country. So, yeah, all of that is part and parcel of the reality of being a football fan, of being a sports fan. And just very briefly, as you said, I went to Lourdes a few years ago and I was standing outside. And a security guard marched up to me and said, "You're standing in the wrong spot. You're clearly here to work." He thought I was a caterer. And he kind of pointed me in the direction of where I should be going. Now, you know, it is outrageous, full stop. And if you think about it, whenever I've gone to Lourdes, a lot of the people working in catering, hardworking, awesome people, look like me. I'm standing outside the members' entrance where women who look like me are not members of Lourdes. So it wasn't kind of like unexpected that that happened. It was kind of shocking to my friends that it happened. It didn't shock me. But to give Lourdes their credit, when I wrote about it for The Guardian, they contacted me immediately and asked me to come in because they wanted to know what happened. So we ended up having a really interesting discussion about, you know, inclusion and exclusion and, you know, what is Lourdes really about and what does it want to be about. So, yeah.
And that's really interesting, right? We've already touched on earlier in the podcast this issue of sports washing. And I do remember a time where you and the other hijabis were extremely popular. You were being invited to meetings all the time and so on. And there was an element of that where it felt like you were being used to airbrush problems that were going on. How far do you think the discussion has come now, and what's the difference between those kind of genuine moves and the kind of superficial role that they wanted you to play in whitewashing the sport?
Yeah, so again, a really interesting observation. So honestly, what we found, Nick, is that as three women campaigners who, you know, work in political space, we work in social justice spaces, we're known for it, we found overwhelmingly that football wanted to keep us very much at arm's length. They did not know what to do with us when we first appeared on the national scene as the three hijabis because we are very political. We don't ever shy away from speaking about what needs to be spoken about. We're very strident and very clear on our values. And so they just didn't know what to do. And we very much felt like if we were bubblegum, you know, if we showed up and said, "Oh, can we have, you know, X or Y footballer's signature and can you give us a shirt?" It may have made life easier for them, because that would have been a very kind of bubblegum response to this. But what they discovered very quickly is that we are here to stay. We're not here to toe the line. We are here to work with people. We believe very much that everyone has a role to play in social justice. And we believe that our role is to be crystal clear and to speak very clearly. Often when institutions and organizations are not willing to speak clearly. So we had a lot of that going on. We had to navigate that space. We were invited into parliament, we were invited into government committee meetings and things like that. But after a while, they kind of started understanding what we were about. I mean, I'm not quite sure why they were confused in the first place, if I'm honest with you. But, you know, they started getting the measure of us. And, you know, to this day, it's a real uphill struggle to actually get into the football governance space to have these conversations, because football is a massively powerful beast, and it has vested interests in all sorts of things which are frankly shady, and that need to be reformed. So you know, it's an interesting time to be in this space, but I also have to say that over a period of time we have access more and more space in football. But our priority is to be rooted in communities and to be rooted with fans. We focus on that more than trying to get access to the hallowed halls of, you know, whoever runs football.
And that feels really important because for fans as well, this is a game which has long ago left, you know, we've left behind this idea that this is a working class game. This is a multi-million pound industry with all sorts of corporate interests involved in it. So it's interesting that there is some common cause there between, you know, what ordinary fans feel about the game and what you're talking about in terms of the structural racism and so on involved.
Absolutely. And I think the thing is, you know, football does remain a very working class sport in this country, which is why politicians show up and, you know, tuck their tie in and roll their shirt sleeves up and start trying to pull pints during World Cups and trying to get down with the people. And they're not really, they're not quite cutting it on that front. We've seen those images one time too many, but it does remain a working class sport. And it's one of the only working class sports where, you know, predominantly, well, we've now got a very successful England women's team. We've got a successful women's league, which is growing, you know, massively. So now you've got working class boys and girls who want to become professional footballers. And this is probably the only sport in the world that offers them that opportunity to cut through and to make it. But for every person who makes it, obviously there are plenty more who continue to play at grassroots level. And that's really the beating heart of football. The beating heart of football is the Sunday leagues. It's, you know, the mums and dads, the carers, the aunties and uncles on the touchline, you know, making sure that they're ferrying, you know, young kids around to play football. That's where the game is. And I think overwhelmingly, most people connect with football through communities. And so there is a big gap between like the top leagues where the money is and where the corporate sponsors are and all of that, and the reality that people face on the ground. And there's also a big disconnect in terms of the political response to that as well. So, you know, War on Want very recently, 2 weeks ago, put out a report looking at the Premier League and looking at the sponsors, you know, the big corporates involved in the Premier League and their complicity in Israel's ongoing genocide in Palestine. It was a very hard-hitting report. It got next to no coverage in mainstream, amongst mainstream sports journalists. I didn't see any club in the Premier League amplifying any of it. It's mostly activists and fan-based groups who are doing it. So I think that as well speaks really loudly to the ethics or lack of ethics of, you know, big football, basically.
Yeah, completely. And we are now approaching this event, premier event in the football calendar, the World Cup. And it's being hosted in Trump's United States. And we know that one of the reasons he wants to host this and is so excited about it is that he thinks it will create this kind of image around the world in a way that, you know, authoritarian regimes have used sporting events throughout history. And we want to challenge that because we've worked together challenging everything that Trump represents. And so you're doing some fantastic work on exposing what's going on here and trying to ensure that this World Cup does not improve the president's, the US president's image. What's the response been so far, both from fans and from competing countries?
Yeah, well, I think that in 10 days' time, the World Cup kicks off. It's going to be a very interesting World Cup because there is no way that this World Cup can be treated as a propaganda tool by Trump or anyone else for that matter. You know, what's going on is utterly horrific, not only in the US with the ICE raids and, you know, the further dehumanizing of immigrants and migrants and, you know, anyone who's deemed to be other over there. But we've got right now we've got an acceleration of Israel's war in Lebanon. And I'm very terrified, along with other football fans, that the World Cup will be used as a cover for Israel to grab more land and to create more carnage. They've already announced that they are rebombing Beirut. So we have to be very mindful of this. You know, often people who don't want us to talk about politics and sports try and suggest that, you know, we're party poopers, you know, we're trying to deny people being joyful and celebrating the World Cup. Well, I would say to those people, we are living in a world where the World Cup takes place. The World Cup is not separate of the rest of the world. And we're in a situation where, you know, dozens of Palestinian footballers have been killed in Israel's genocide in Gaza. Entire football pitches have been literally wiped off the face of the earth. Massive swathes of Gaza, you can see from satellite images from space, no longer exist. So in which world would it be okay for all of, would it not be okay even for us not to talk about this and to be honest about it? You know, the last
and some footballers have, right? Some footballers have spoken out about it, but of course the big institutions have said nothing.
Absolutely. Some footballers have spoken out about it, you know, Mo Salah, for example, and others. And we know that when footballers speak, the world takes notice, right? The last World Cup was held in Qatar, and rightly so, there was a massive spotlight on labor rights, on immigrants' rights, on LGBTI rights. There was, if you compare it to what's going on in the US, there's almost deafening silence in relation to what we're seeing in the US, you know, and also, you know, let's look at Canada as well and Mexico. You know, Mexico is a stunning country, as we know, and it's home to some of the highest rates of gender-based violence in the world. And none of this is being talked about. And the question is, why not? If it's been talked about in Qatar as it should have been, why is it not being talked about here? The rank hypocrisy that we're seeing. But I think the good thing is that more and more football fans are asking questions and they're demanding answers. And they're not getting any as yet, or they're getting few answers. But I think this push to really demand better from football is only going to grow. And frankly, FIFA, you know, the world governing body, what it's been doing, I mean, I'm stumbling for words here because FIFA is loathed by most genuine football fans. We know that. But even by their very woeful, low standards, they have excelled themselves on this one, you know, handing Trump an award, you know, the FIFA award for peace. I mean, the award didn't even exist before that.
It was when he was launching this Gaza Peace Board, right? That the head of FIFA was there right next to him. I mean, I couldn't believe it was really, really unbelievable.
Well, the thing is, too many unbelievable things have now become normalized, and this is what we need to push against. So I know from your other guests as well that there's very, very brave people in the countries that are hosting the World Cup who are standing up to authoritarianism. They are literally facing beaten up by the authorities, facing jail terms, and they will continue to protest this World Cup. You know, we're not against football. We know that football is a game for the world, and I don't exaggerate when I say that. It brings people together in incredible ways. And this is another reason why it's so devastating that, once again, a global football tournament is being used as propaganda for an authoritarian regime. But this time it's in North America, not in the Middle East, or not in, you know, Nazi Germany or somewhere else, you know. And there's precedent, there's history throughout the world where sports has been co-opted for the purpose of propaganda, for the purpose of normalizing fascism. And we are very much here in this moment now. The only difference now is that it almost becomes controversial if you call this what it is. I do believe, though, that as the World Cup unravels, and I use that word purposefully because it definitely is going to unravel. It already is. We've got players from the Iraqi national football team who've been denied visas. We've got players from the Senegalese team who've been denied visas. We've got the Iran team who's not traveling to the World Cup. There was attempts to try and replace them with Italy. Astounding, right? And it goes on and it goes on. And let's not forget that this is going to be the hottest World Cup on records. Now, this is not me sexualizing the players. I'm talking about the climate crisis and the fact that Trump has ripped up all the agreements and denies, you know, only a few days ago, he's rambling again, you know, about the scientific evidence around climate being a hoax. So if you put all of this together, this is quite staggering that this World Cup has been handed over. And then in many ways, it's kind of true to form of FIFA and how it behaves. So I think a reckoning is also coming for FIFA. And I do believe this World Cup is going to not be the propaganda that the US wants in particular. And I think that people power and fan power is going to come into its own. It may start off slowly, but I think it's definitely going to, you know, it's going to gather at pace and accelerated.
Brilliant. You're not obviously asking people not to watch the World Cup simply because it's been happening in the United States. But we are asking people to approach the World Cup in a different way to how they may normally do it. And we've seen in the past athletes and supporters using armbands banners, gestures, and so on, small acts of resistance that can convey our message and show that as much as people love football, they absolutely hate the president of the country it's being held in. What are you hoping for this time?
Yeah, so I believe that some teams will definitely protest, their fans will. Obviously, they face a militarized police force in every city in the US in particular that's hosting the World Cup. So the stakes are very high if you're going to speak up and stand up, but I believe that will happen. I think people will find multiple ways of doing it. They'll find it through digital action, online action. I'm part of the Football Against Fascism campaign, which obviously is Stop Trump coalition campaign. And one of the things we're encouraging people to do is to hold watch parties, hold them in your neighborhoods, at home, and start having those discussions. Let's talk about what is going on, in relation to the World Cup. But let's talk about the ICE raids. Let's talk about the climate injustice. Let's talk about racial injustice. I mean, like I said, there might be people out there saying, oh, why can't we just watch a game? Well, it's not that simple, is it? You know, the World Cup is literally being co-opted by Donald Trump, and none of us real football fans should allow that. So I think this is an opportunity to have those conversations in your workplace, for example. I'm wearing my England shirt very proudly, and I plan to be wearing my England shirt to not only support the team, but to also, frankly, peeve off a few racists who believe that someone like me, born and raised in this country, is not fit to wear an England shirt. Well, if someone like me is not going to wear an England shirt, who is? I'm part of a trio of British Muslim women who literally put our heads up to stand up for our national men's football team. So if we're not going to wear the England shirt, who isn't? And I'll just wrap up on that point, Nick, by telling you that my family are from Pakistan originally. And when my parents first came to this country in the 60s, they were terrified when England were playing because of the level of hooliganism. They were being called the P word on the streets. They refused to get on a bus. You know, they stay at home. And I feel really proud that despite the, deep fueling of racism across Europe, not just here in the UK, that I feel proud to wear this shirt and my nephews and nieces feel proud to wear this shirt because, frankly, we have reclaimed the shirt back. And there will be a lot of that going on as well. And I think this is also testament to the England men's team in particular, who have stood up and they've decided to stand up and be counted in the past. And I hope that they will continue to do that because that's the only way to to show your values. You have to live them.
Absolutely. And I mean, I grew up at a time where English fans were known for racist rioting, both in this country and overseas, like horrible, horrible acts of violence. And that was my association for very many years with football. And I do think, of course, there are many problems still there, but it has been transformed. And it's been transformed, as you say, through fans themselves taking action and people being fearless about saying it's my absolute right to enjoy this sport. And that's how change happens, right? That's how community level change happens.
You have to collectively take up space. Decent minded people need to stop being shy and apologetic. We need to take up all the space because, as we said when we launched the Three Hijabis all those years ago, that football belongs to all of us. It doesn't belong to the racists. Our national men's team and our women's team, for that matter, they represent us. They don't represent a fringe group of very loud racists and fascists. And I do believe they're a fringe group. The problem is that they are being amplified by many people in power. And so it's a frightening time, but we have to get behind our team. We have to make sure that they are not co-opted by these people and that they are also given courage by us as well, to stand up and be counted. So I'm not really looking forward to the World Cup, I'll be honest with you. It's something that I have always loved. You know, as a kid, I used to collect the stickers and, all the sticker albums and things like that. And, for me as a child, I remember being a vivid dreamer, particularly around the World Cup. I'm not looking forward to this World Cup. I feel apprehensive about it. I am feeling stressed about it because, those of us who are paying attention to what's going on in the world, how can we kind of just sit back and think, well, we can just enjoy a game of football because it's not that straightforward. It's not that simple. Having said that, when England play I will be watching the games. I'll be watching all the other games as well. And if it goes to penalty shootouts, like it did with Arsenal and PSG the other night, I will be hiding behind the sofa because that's what I always do. But, you know, I'm sure the excitement will start bubbling up. But, I think it's really imperative that no one tries to sports wash what is going on, including our mainstream football commentators and our mainstream channels. They need to report accurately on what's going on. And I think that we are going to see lots and lots of football fans being denied entry to the US. And we need to know about that. We need to hear about that as well.
Brilliant. I want to thank you so, so much, Shaista, both for coming on the podcast, but obviously for all that you're doing. I know that the next few weeks are going to be really hectic for you. So please stay. But also stay strong, and we'll keep on amplifying everything that you're doing and let people know how they can support and help out.
Great. Thank you so much. Take care, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you again to Chris, Daniel and Shaista for joining us today. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of Counterpower, produced by Another Europe is Possible, Global Justice Now and the Stop Trump Coalition. If you're watching the World Cup this year, enjoy the football, but also remember the context in which it's taking place. I think one of the biggest takeaways from each of our guests today is that when fans campaign, they can change the politics around the sport. To get more involved, go to footballagainstfascism.org. And lastly, don't forget to like, subscribe, and follow Counterpower. And if you've learned something from this episode, you can help us grow the podcast by leaving a positive review. We'll see you again soon. Thank you.